because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver, the founder, CEO, and creative mind behind BasketballImmersion.com. This is the podcast where you will hear real basketball coaching conversations. Whether you are a new or experienced coach at any level of basketball, these coaching conversations will give you practical ideas to stimulate your coaching and make what you do even better. Without any more delay, let's share the game. Welcome to the Basketball Coaching Podcast. My name is Chris Oliver, host of the Basketball Immersion Coaching Podcast. I'm here today with Amanda Butler. Amanda Butler just got named as the Clemson Women's Basketball Coach. Formerly, she was the head coach at the University of Florida and has had tremendous success as a Division I head coach, posting over 230 wins and in her 12 years of coaching. I got a chance to meet Amanda last year when she took sabbatical from coaching, and we had a great conversation at Detroit Pistons practice. And you know, I know it's going to be gold for all of our listeners. Welcome, Amanda.
Thanks, Chris. I'm excited to be here and to have another opportunity to just talk with you again about something that we both love, and that's just like comparing ideas and looking at basketball from different angles and different people's perspectives. So thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, wonderful, and grateful that we have this chance again. And I took a sabbatical 3 years ago, so I know a little bit what you went through in terms of having so much learning and so many great ideas come into your playbook, into your philosophy book, into your coaching book, and all these different things. And let's get right into it. Let's share some of those ideas that I think have impacted what can help other coaches, but have impacted you on that year off.
Well, the whole idea of the way I wanted my year to be shaped, and then how successful I felt like it was in terms of just the amount of information and new relationships that I was really overwhelmed with has really impacted, I think, the way I will prioritize having similar experiences, but maybe on a smaller scale, because obviously having another year probably, hopefully, is not going to present itself in the same way that it did the first time. But there was just such tremendous value in trying to identify what is an area that I've never really, maybe I've been in it, but I've just dipped my toe in it, but that I can sort of immerse myself in, that is going to lend me a completely different lens than I've ever had before. And that space for me was primarily in the NBA with a lot of college men's basketball practices as well. And then just a lot of hot pursuit of conversations with people that I got to meet along the way that if I wasn't in those environments, I probably wouldn't have crossed paths with. That different lens just opened up like a whole new part of my brain that I didn't even know was there. And so, and like I said, in terms of going forward, you know, I've even told my staff, I will even sacrifice a couple days of recruiting to go back to training camps and to spend an extended amount of time in one camp, not hop around as much, but try and study the subtleties of the way that people communicate, the way that they're messaging, the priorities in their programs, the subtleties in how they teach, and then ultimately, what are they teaching? The X's and O's and the new ways of defending ball screens or looking at the floor and how to space it and the million other things that you pick up when you go to those training camps.
Well, one of the things, I mean, you mentioned is obviously challenging yourself in different ways. And I think that's so important for coaches to understand that if you're doing the same thing over and over again, there's a limited amount of improvement you can make as a coach and a limited amount you can probably bring back to your players or your staff as well. So certainly I admire you for that. And I think that's important for coaches to understand. In terms of some of those things, do you see a lot of those things being able to transfer to your new situation now at Clemson?
Oh, 100%. And I know a lot of the things that, in particular, that you and I shared, you know, those ideas of how you practice. And I've followed up on a lot of the things that you and I talked about, but how can I make practice better? I think that in large part, when I look back at my history as a head coach, practices looked a certain way, and I thought they were good practices. And I still do. I still stand by a lot of the ways I was teaching things, but I look at what those guys were doing on the highest level. And, you know, and it kind of made me think, we're just not playing enough. And we're not playing enough 3-on-3. But just straight up 5-on-5 basketball, making sure that we're playing. And drills are important teaching tools, don't get me wrong. But I think in a lot, especially in women's basketball, maybe in college basketball in general, drills maybe play too much of a role and there's not enough actual competition in practice because that is what translates the best into games. And so being able to see that in a lot of different ways, a lot of different scenarios that were created in those practices, I know that that's definitely something that I will carry forward, already am, in our summer individual workouts. Even when we're teaching a skill that may be brand new to one of our competitors, we're ending every workout making sure we're playing one-on-one or we're playing three-on-three, and then giving them some parameters in which to do that. Some of the really cool things that were just, again, observations that I think it's worth sharing. I'm assuming that maybe a lot of your audience may be college coaches or maybe even high school coaches or younger coaches. One of the things that I thought was encouraging was the things that we think of at our level as issues that we feel like we are dealing with that makes us significant and special are the same even in the NBA. You know, the distractions or the things that when practice is over or a hard day is over that we're frustrated with, those same issues seem to exist at every level. And to me, that was sort of encouraging. Like, I'm not attracting a certain sort of thing in my program and I need to do something different. These are kind of struggles or challenges everywhere at every level that are there maybe for a purpose. And then the other thing that was sameness, as I got to see a lot of differences, this other sameness that was there was really an emphasis and a need for fundamentals to be taught really, really well. I mean, I was going back through some of my notes before we jumped on here, and one of the very first, actually was the first meeting that I got to be in when I spent some time with the Pistons, you know, they were talking about, we have to be a better ball fake team, and we've got to do a better job creating off the dribble. I mean, like, they were just these really basic things, but it just demonstrated to me how important those are at every level as well. And it doesn't change, you know, when you're coaching a 25-year-old multimillionaire who's going to be an all-star. So that was kind of cool.
Well, that's great. I mean, the sameness part of it also applies to the fact that a lot of things that you were doing got confirmed for you. And that's also just as important for coaches to learn, is that when you go observe some of these practices, it's not just about what you see that you don't like. It's not just what you see that's new. It's also getting some confirmation that what you're doing is on the right track, philosophically or technically, tactically. And I'm sure you saw that as well in terms of that sameness.
Yeah, no doubt. And I appreciate you bringing that up, because I spent some time with the Celtics and I went immediately from them to Oklahoma City and spent some time with their G League team. Like, what did you learn at Boston? And, you know, and to kind of put it into categories, you know, I learned at first, it was like, okay, wow, I don't know anything. And then you sit there for a while and you absorb things for a couple of days, and then kind of to your point, then you realize I know a lot more than I thought I did. And it was humbling. And then in the next moment, it would be, like you said, reaffirming or confirming, wow, I am doing some things that we need to continue on, but maybe we can improve, or maybe we can twist to the right or twist to the left a little bit and make them a little bit better.
Yeah, that's great. And it's those little details, as you alluded to, with the ball fake and different things like that, that does make a big difference. And at this point in your coaching career, clearly those little details are a huge focus. You talked about communication and relationships. Can you share some of the things that you noticed about those things at the different practices you were at?
Yeah, no doubt. You know, one of the things that was a common thread in every practice and with every team and group of coaches that I got to observe or spend time was, there was a level of sincerity in the way that they spoke to people that was really powerful. And whether that was a visitor at their practice or whether that was their best player or whether that was someone on their staff, there was also a super high level, I felt like, of self-awareness and comfort and confidence in who the leader or whoever was conveying the message and who they were. They really knew who they were. And they didn't shy away from that, whether that was, you know, a younger person like Brad Stevens, who doesn't have the track record of Stan Van Gundy, but then Stan Van Gundy communicated in a way that was very uniquely and comfortably and confidently him. And I feel like, you know, that resonates with everyone. Everyone wants to respond to that authenticity and that genuine character in terms of, whatever this person is saying to me, he or she really, really believes, and they're saying it in a way that they can best share it with me to help me. I think that's a message that goes really, really far. One of the other things that I thought was, this is what I started tracking, and this was at the beginning of my time watching practices. I didn't have this idea until I got in the midst of it, was how good at messaging each program, each coach, each organization was. You knew sometimes just by walking into the building what the messages were going to be because of the way the place was decorated or the things that were posted on the wall. But then being able to sit in meetings and then being able to sit in practices and listening to what was being said, the word choice, not just the message, but then the word choice, how consistent that was across staffs, and then how it came to life in practices. And so intentional messaging has really become something, again, that was kind of one of those things I thought I was doing a pretty good job of, but it was really neat to see that at highest level be so important. And then also to be so consistent across every program I got to see, whether it was an MBA team or whether it was a high-level college team, whoever the successful coaches were, that was something that was important in the way they were communicating and then also the way that they were teaching. I think it made it easier for their players to learn too.
Because there was say, that direct
wrapped in simplicity. Yeah, yeah, no doubt.
And I love that wording.
You mentioned that the previous time we talked about intentional messaging. And I've definitely taken that to heart in terms of understanding that a little bit more and focusing on that with the different coaches or different places I've been around. Can you give us a specific example from one of the places about an example that would help coaches understand what you're talking about in terms of intentional messaging?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So again, this is just off the top of my head, and I'll give you a little bit more insight into how I try to learn from it here later on. But when you walk into, and you saw this, when you walk into the Detroit Pistons practice facility, the first thing that you see on a wall is a giant message of be impactful. And that was not a Stan Van Gundy message. That came all the way from the top down, the ownership. But it was translated in the way they were trying to coach, in the way that they were trying to form a team, even when you looked at the selection of players. And then when you interacted with those fellas, the way that they talked, you could tell that they were people who were trying to be impactful, whether it was in that conversation with me that I got to experience or whether it was in the way that they were playing. And so a really simple message, but they had a very specific idea of what it meant to be impactful. And so that was one of the ones. And like I said, giant wall on the practice court that was covered with that. I took pictures of that. I thought that was really cool. And so that was something I started to notice when I went other places. I went and watched a practice in Charlotte, and in the Hornets practice facility, they had messages that were more related, not necessarily philosophies like a life philosophy, but their defensive and offensive philosophies. They were posted on the wall, big giant signs, which I thought was really, really cool. And then there were other things that were maybe more daily messages, that there were more of them where you couldn't post them everywhere. And in Oklahoma City, Mark Dagnall, their G League coach there, is to me is master in this, and just the way they would teach. So, you know, they're teaching how they want to play help side defense. And so they would use very often like 3-word phrases like load with length, so that it was something that was catchy and sort of easy to remember, but it was also a teaching point of when you're getting to your load spots, load with length. So get your hands up, get your arms out, you know, be a big, tall, long guy when you get in there. And so I think it was a combination of those things. And like I said, one of the things that I discovered as I realized, you know, this was something that was really compelling and I thought was neat. And also it was something I knew I would use going forward. That was what at each place when I was leaving there, I tried to take note every single day of what I felt like their messages were. And then I made a collection of the messages, you know, the Boston Celtic messages, the Detroit Piston messages, the Oklahoma City messages. And that's one of the things I like to review very often, because it kind of gives you a different way of teaching, a different type of language that might resonate with a lesson you're trying to teach that day, or, you know, whatever the case may be.
Yeah. So the efficiency of language obviously helps
learning. And for you, you also got to feel each day to challenge yourself to get decide on your own. What was the emphasis of that practice? And that comes through in the messaging that you're talking about. That's awesome. Yeah. Those are wonderful examples. And I'm glad you shared those to give coaches even more examples. Because I think too often we post quotes or we talk about quotes and we don't really connect them back to why we're actually talking about them on a daily basis. And that's so important. And that messaging comes through. For your players, I found one of the things that when I go watch these, especially for my players, go and watch pro practices, NBA practices, I can come back to them with stories, with examples. And it helps my players connect learning so much, just in the same way I think statistics have helped me take that to another level as well, when you can talk to a player about points per possession. But are you using some of these stories, some of these experiences to connect your players to things that you're teaching?
Oh, 100%. You know, one of the things that I think at every level that needs to continually be taught and emphasized is shooting and shooting properly. And one of the things that I think resonates with anybody who watches any professional basketball beyond just flipping through the channels, it's gotten a lot of attention. Like, I think about the Celtics and I think about, you know, Marcus Smart and his pregame routines, Steph Curry's pregame routines and what those look like. And different people have different viewpoints of that, of are they showy or are they really practical or whatever. But that's one of the things that we've only had summer workouts, had the opportunity to have summer workouts here. But that's one of the specific examples that maybe doesn't fall into a story as much as, like, these guys are the best in the world at what they do. And part of what gets them ready to be the best every single day is they have this routine that makes them comfortable, that it is practical warm up for how they want to play the game. And I think at the college level, very often, and it's also very individual and unique to each one of those players. And I think very often at the college level, maybe the high school level, we give those things to our players and say, go here, do this. This is how you warm up. And so that was one of the things I've really encouraged my players to do. The only thing I've given them is said, I want you to have your own routine. You know, I think at this point, how we want you to shoot the ball, or here's some good ideas for how to warm up, but make it your own. Be an individual in that space. Be an individual in that regard. And do the same thing every single day so that your mind and your body, when you get into that routine, the same way we have our free throw routines and that makes us confident about shooting that free throw, we try to perfect the routine so that we make the free throw. Same sort of thing as when we go into a practice. And so that's one of the stories I talked about, Kyrie Irving or Al Horford or any of those guys that I got to sit there and watch. They walked out to the court and they had their warm-up. They didn't deviate from it because it was a confidence builder for them. And that's one maybe story or maybe a good practice that I've shared with my team, and I think they've really enjoyed it to this point.
Well, that's outstanding on many levels. And
I mean, for me, the first thing that connects with is giving some freedom to a player. And I'm big on that, obviously, that I think as coaches, we control too many things. So if we can find something that we can help guide them, we're not saying, hey, just go do it on your own. We're guiding them to coming up with their own individual routine that now when they walk onto the practice floor, they have something that's unique. It's their own. They're empowered by that. And it also gives you as a coach something to step away from to be able to give them their own voice. And that's pretty powerful. And, you know, that is a great example because you see that at all those levels of NBA. As soon as they step on the floor for practice or step on the floor for a game, they're in their routine. And it's not coach-led, it's player-led.
Yeah, 100%. And that's one of the other observations, Chris, you know, that piggyback off what you just said, you know, player-led instead of coach-led. That partnership dynamic that exists at the NBA level to me is very admirable as well. And I think a lot of that translates into being a successful coach of the future at the college level. That partnership, when we have a whole new slew of NCAA rules now that are about time management and time demands with our student athletes. And really, it's not saying, hey, student athletes, do whatever you want to do now. We're going to give you all this freedom with your time. It's more so of like, instead of me just handing you a calendar every week and go, this is what you're going to do, or every month, it's more so of having a conversation about, here's how I want the week to go. Does this day off work for you? Or would this day off be better? You know, and I think that partnership dynamic is foundational at the NBA level. And it's something that I think we can bring to the college game that improves relationships. And like I said, is going to be a very big part of how we operate going forward.
You're making what I call, you're helping one of your players become an active participant in their development, in their learning, in the whole process that you're trying to sell them on. And I believe that translates at all levels of basketball. And I don't think we do that as enough as coaches, because I know it's hard because, again, you know the answer already as a coach. Right. And it's easier for you sometimes to just give the answer, to create the structure, to create the warm-up. But at the end of the day, it's much more powerful when the players are empowered and feel that they are actively involved in the process. So that's some gold, Coach. Thanks for sharing that part of that. Coming back a little bit, we talked about the level of coaching. And I think sometimes there's a misconception, whether it's at the NCAA level or the NBA level, that a lot of coaches roll at the balls. You know, that it's like, you got talent. Well, you know, you're not coaching to the same level. And I mean, anyone that's dug deep into it at any level, you know that the quality of coaching is there. So there was active coaching going on all the practices you went to. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, that's some of the parts that honestly drew me. Like I said, I wanted to be uncomfortable and I wanted to see things through a different lens. And it's not any secret. At the college level, we spend a giant amount of our time doing things besides coaching. We are recruiting. We're doing a lot of different hats. And that was one of the things that I always thought was really cool about the NBA is a majority of what those guys are doing is just thinking about coaching every day. And so, you know, what are their meetings going to sound like? What are their practices going to look like? You know, that was one of the things I was really certainly after. You know, in terms of what practices looked like, now that was something that was very different at every different place. But one of the things that impressed me that it certainly made me think hard and fast about maybe how I've limited my players in the past was these NBA coaches, and you've seen this over and over again, they don't hold back in terms of what their expectations are for their players to know. They will make adjustments, and they might make 10 of them. They may, in one practice, put in 6 new wrinkles in a play. And that may be a little bit extreme. Maybe that doesn't translate 100% to what we can do at the college level because our guys are also going to class and they have to wear more than just the athlete hat as well. But it did make me think a lot about the amount of information that they were giving in practices. And then 2 minutes after they show the new wrinkle, they're playing and expected to be able to execute that. That was a little convicting for me because I think in the past, I certainly have gone, now, wait a minute, that's too much. You know, we can't put that in the day. We have to wait till tomorrow, or we have to wait till we have a 2-day break.
Or you're just focused, it's our system.
Our system will work. And not as willing to make the adjustments. Yeah. No, that's awesome. I mean, those adjustments are, again, I mean, certainly they have a higher level of player, so they can hire, you know, handle potentially a higher level adjustments. But again, we can't be inflexible as coaches to add wrinkles or to add different things that can impact our players' development or our team success. And you're right. I mean, what were some of the adjustments that you noticed that kind of stood out to you?
Well, I think, you know, really, I start to head down like a defensive trail, and then I think about 4 or 5 things I saw offensively. I think the defensive part of it probably was so many different coverages. There's so many different ways that they approach, let's just say, something that everyone can relate to, like ball screens. And so I go back to what I said earlier. In the preseason, in their preliminary like training camp or pre-training camp workouts, there was a lot of 3-man work. And that was so that they could have a chance to get comfortable with footwork and then terminology, which is something that we haven't even gone down that rabbit hole yet. That's kind of endless in every program. You learn how to speak different languages. They did a really, really good job of building from 3-man approach. What does icing mean? Okay, now ice to veer, okay? Now ice to veer if we're guarding Kyrie Irving. And, you know, now ice to veer if we're guarding a ball screen is Kyrie Irving with Al Horford as the screener. Those were the level of adjustments that I think do go maybe a little bit deeper than maybe what we could expect from our college players. But those were things that were happening daily. And, you know, and I think it goes back to they did a great job in their 3-man teaching segments of those guys understanding the terminology and then the knowledge. And I'm kind of getting off path here a little bit, but I think NBA players do not get enough credit at all for how smart they have to be to not just survive but thrive in that league. There are no dummies that are playing NBA basketball because they have a lot of information in their brain. And one of the areas where their players are sometimes maybe even more advanced than their coaches in terms of the knowledge is how to guard individual players. And that's one of the things going back to the partnership dynamic where you have to really give those NBA coaches credit for, well, they will get that feedback from their players of, do you think you can get up on the guy or do you need to be standing back or, you know, do you need to force him right, left? Do we need to play this ball screen as a weak? Do we need to try? Do we just straight up switch? You know, but those were some of the things that I think in practice where they didn't spend a lot of time teaching it. The expectation was, we've already taught you how to do this. Now we're going to tell you how we want to approach it differently. Now go out there and apply it. And it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's one of the things 3 years ago when I took
that sabbatical that I took away immediately was how quickly they got into talking about a specific situation with a specific player example from another team. And I've actually brought that into my coaching quite a bit now, that I'm not afraid to mention a player from another team, even if we're not playing that team this week, because that player does something really well that we have to learn how to cover, but that applies to so many other players. That just happens to be the best player that does it.
No, you know, no doubt.
And it does connect the idea really quickly. Coach, you also talked about the unique language. And that's something that, you know, I think, again, the common misconception is that NBA, they all use the same words.
And no way.
They don't. They don't.
No way.
You
no
said
way.
You went to each practice. You had to learn like a whole new language.
Yeah, I was lost at least the first half of every day until you kind of decode. You know, I was going back and looking at some of my notes, and I even had to kind of sit there for a second and go, okay, now in Boston, what did scram mean? Okay, now in Detroit, what did chest mean? And it goes back to what you said, though, and this is something that I know much more of a stickler as a head coach now in this new position at Clemson, and making sure that we are very clear about what our way is of referring to actions, whether they're offensive, defensive, whatever, that we have our language and that everyone is using it. Because in a bigger picture, there is significance and importance and empowerment. And we do this differently than everyone else. And so this is what we're going to call this. And no one else calls it this. And so let's use that because that distinguishes us. And then back to your earlier point, there's also the element of efficiency of when you say in Boston or in Oklahoma City, when you say red, everyone knows exactly what red means. They know which side of the ball you're on. They know what exact the action is. And, you know, that's really efficient, you know, but there's also conciseness there, you know. And for me, again, I talked about self-awareness. I talk a lot. I can start talking too much. I can start using too many words. And so if we have our terminology, and you're expected to be, you have to be accountable for knowing that terminology, then maybe that also keeps us from over-teaching and wasting practice time.
No, that's a great point in terms of that. And that's, I mean, for me, that comes back to something special.
For me, which is maximizing time on task, making sure your players are actively engaged in playing the game, you know, whether it's a drill, a skill, or playing 3-on-3, 5-on-5, that they're actually doing that rather than listening to you. And it's funny you mention all that because I actually had a player in a workout last night that I stopped 4 times and asked him 4 different questions about language. And he only got 2 of the 4 right. And the immediate thing to him was, well, how are you ever going to learn beyond this if you don't get our basic words down?
Yeah.
Because we talk this way. We're not changing for you. We all already talk this way. Yeah. And he was a new player to our program and just emphasized to him and to the other newcomers how important language was. And that's a great point for all coaches. You've obviously spent time at the WNBA level as well in terms of attending training camps and being a part of that. Did you see a lot of similarities in terms of the two?
Some. The thing that is really different about the WNBA as opposed to the NBA is that the WNBA season is in the summer, okay? And so very often in training camps for WNBA, because more money can be made playing ball overseas, you may go to a WNBA training camp and the 2 or 3 best players on that team may not be at training camp yet because they're finishing their season in Russia or Spain or China or wherever it is that they're playing because they make more money overseas than they do in the WNBA training camps. And so it's very different. And also roster sizes are small. Resources are very, very different. There are not 8 assistant coaches, you know. In the NBA, the resources seem to have no ceiling. You know, I'm sure that owners and GMs don't feel that way. But from my perspective, I'm sitting there going, now, who's that guy? Who's that guy? You know, there's so many people that are involved with the NBA training camps. So some of the concepts that you and I talked about already, efficiency in WNBA camps are really, really important because you only have 2 assistant coaches. So there's a lot of different elements that maybe college is probably somewhere in between those two, but it's hard to get the essence of teams a lot of times from the WNBAs because their best players aren't there. Sometimes, not always. The level of teaching, the level of coaching is outstanding, but also their training camp window is a lot smaller. And if there are any people that have watched WNBA and certainly made judgments about whether you think it's good or bad, if you saw it at the beginning of the season, it improved significantly because there are so few practices for those women at the beginning of their seasons. And then by playoff time, you're seeing, you know, the best women's basketball in the world.
That's a great observation. I've always thought about that because there's less of an ongoing connection with a player than there is at the NBA level because they're playing overseas the majority of their season. So even from the individual development phase, like a lot of those players don't get that off-season individual development phase, which has become
obviously such an important part of an NBA player's development. They're basically playing year round.
They are.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I haven't made it there yet, but I definitely want to. It's on my list because I know it's an approach that's a little different and in some ways more relatable to some of our other levels where we don't have the same advantages as well.
Definitely.
Time or resources or whatnot. So
yeah, definitely. Yeah. The other factor that you have to weave in there is fatigue factor. You know, a lot of these women have just played an entire season of professional basketball at a high level somewhere else. And if they're missing part of training camp, it's probably because their team was really good and they went deep into whatever their playoff structure was. And then they're starting a brand new season with a brand new team just finishing up. I mean, it's pretty amazing when you think about it. At the same time, you know, one of those things in women's basketball, we would love to see those WNBA players be able to make more money so that they didn't have to have two competitive seasons. And really that would raise the level of play in the WNBA even higher. But that's just where we are right now. And hopefully that can be something in the future that we see.
You said something else in there that I thought was fascinating.
And I'm sure you have some comments on it, but the value of the work to rest ratio, like just the value of conserving energy, you know, at all levels of basketball has become such an important topic. And clearly there's wearable technology and there's different things like that that can help tracking of that. But beyond those things, which most of us don't have access to, what were some of the things that you noticed in terms of valuing a player and valuing their energy levels?
Well, I think that the coaches that were sensitive to my guys are tired today. We're just going to do a walkthrough. You know, we're not going to get taped. We're not going to even go for an hour. We're not even going to shoot. I think those, when you talked at the beginning of this in terms of the relationship and the connection and the authenticity, the players that felt like their coaches were really sensitive to, this is what my load has looked like this week. And so we have a day when we can practice, but we're not going to. I think those players respond to those coaches even better because they feel like the coach really appreciates where their body is and what their needs are, as opposed to just, you know, that old school, like, well, we got a day, so we got to practice. And the only way we can get better is if we practice. And I think there was a great attention to that at the NBA level, the whole field of sports science and tracking these guys' loads. But still, the head coaches still had the option to buy in to that science or not. And I think that it's great science. I think it's great indicators. I mean, we're learning so much about the power of recovery and sleep and all of those things. And I think the organizations where, from not just the scientific components, but the coaches as well, were really respecting all of that new information that's evolving, I think that their player buy-in to that coach were also high. But that was definitely, I'm glad you brought that one up. We have a lot of the heart rate monitors and a lot of the tracking, a lot of the systems here at Clemson. And I don't know that I would have appreciated the value of all those numbers and that information as much if I hadn't seen it working at that NBA level. Now, those guys are playing, what, 82 games, 90 games. The guys that we watched play last night are even over that. You know, that's an extreme that we don't have at the college level. However, the reality of the mental fatigue of being a student at our level and then the physical fatigue of a season that at this point in our history really doesn't end either. Now that we have summer access and we do individual workouts and we can do training as soon as the fall starts and then official practice begins in September, I think it's something that we really have to make important if we want to see the performances in February and March that we hope for.
And the most practical display of that at your level
is that you practice more. That you have more practice slots, so your potential to overtrain a player through practice is a little bit higher than at the NBA level. And certainly at the NBA level, there's a different philosophy of in-season practice. And we won't get into that. But how do you reflect now, or how do you connect back to, you know, what you're going to do with your practice duration and your practice energy to work ratios as you go through this process?
Yeah, you know, I think I've always kind of been one of those people, and maybe it's because of how I'm wired. I'm not really interested in having a four-hour practice. That's not fun for anybody.
No,
and so I like the shorter duration, higher intensity approach. You know, there are so many wonderful things that we can do now with film and how we can teach and maximize mental training. You know, and those are some areas and some spaces here that I want us to really perfect and get really good at. Certainly, there's no substitute for getting on the floor and, you know, practicing your skills, honing your craft with defense and with competition. But I also think that we have our student athletes get iPads here, and we've got people on our staff that can film every workout, every practice, can get us film clips from the NBA, from the WNBA, from other college teams, men or women. I think we've got to maximize a lot of that as well. Going back to what I'd said earlier, if we want them to have a greater capacity mentally to make adjustments in some of those things, it's not spend more time on the practice floor. It's train their mind to see something, hear something, and then adjust to those somethings in a shorter amount of time.
Great, you coach, know, just to add to that, I mean, we saw that,
whether it's before practice, before game, that there's an assistant coach sitting down beside a player with a laptop and going through video. And what we could assume is individual video, and that was happening constantly. Mm-hmm. And that made a huge impact on me. Now, some of us, again, don't have the resources, don't have full-time assistants or assistants available, but it just struck me as saying, like, why are we not doing that more than even group video? You know, because group video, no matter what, you don't connect with everyone.
It makes people sleepy.
Exactly. So we honestly try, we've made that adjustment that we try to do less or no group video and all individual video.
That's something that I think for me will be a little bit of a discovery process this year, because I feel the same way that you do. And we will still have group video. I don't know, revolutionary enough maybe to completely rule it out. I think it does have a place, but the length of it and what we're showing them, I think, is something that I will take a hard look at, because an individual is going to stay engaged for 30 minutes of film if the film is about him or her. 15 individuals watching film about other people, you know, as we do our scouting, probably not realistic. So it has made me take pause and reevaluate maybe some of the things that, you know, are those old school notions of like, all right, well, we're going to get in here. We played bad. We're going to get in here and watch the whole game, you know. I don't know that that really has an impact on anyone. Maybe it makes the coach feel like they're doing something, but that's not really the measure of success, is how the coach feels. It's, you know, what's translating into results and effectiveness that's being received by those players.
Well, your situation's unique in a way, because clearly you come in with a blank slate, because your players really don't know you. They're getting to know you now, but they really don't know, and they can't just fall back on, well, we used to do it this way.
Yeah,
because with you, they don't know. So it's kind of a perfect time for you to come in with, you know, with this mindset of whatever you're going to do, it's going to be a situation where your players are going to be open to it, because they're ready to have some change and ready to move forward. So yeah, it's going to be fascinating. Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to watch. So you said, let's circle back to this, because I love that you said this, because I have a hard time with the term individual workout. Mm-hmm. And you said within your individual workouts, you do some 3-on-3. You know, mm-hmm. you do some 1-on-1, which I value tremendously, and you do 3-on-3. And I find that not enough coaches connect those ideas, that whatever your skill work is ultimately has to get applied. And the mm-hmm. easiest way to apply it is obviously in 1-on-1 and 3-on-3 in those type of lower impact situations, off-season training, et cetera. So can you talk about that a little bit? Is that what you're doing within your workouts?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you know, we're spending a great deal of time trying to introduce a new way of doing things, and some of the things you and I've already talked about, a new way of talking. As the saying goes, there's many, many ways that you can skin a cat. And so maybe we're retraining and reshaping some thoughts on how to approach offense and defense. But more than anything, what we want to be really, really sure about in our team this year is that we have very similar thoughts and expectations about how we will compete. The technical parts of it, we may not nail those every single night, but we want to be really clear about an expectation of competing, being a tough competitor, like what that means. And there's only one way we can actually teach that. It's not for me to talk about it and, you know, pound my fist in my hand and raise my voice. We actually have to compete. And then the other part of that, besides teaching them what we mean and what our expectation is as coaches in terms of competition, is also that, going back to one of the other ideas we just talked about, we're not going to watch film with individuals of them doing drills. That's not going to help them get better unless we want them to learn drills better. So it creates, even in the summer, an opportunity for us to put together not 30 minutes of film, but maybe 5 clips of, here were 5 great shots that you took yesterday when we played 3-on-3. And then that hopefully helps them understand when we get bigger picture and we're playing more 5-on-5, or we're introducing systems or opponents' defenses, that we all really, really understand because we've practiced watching our great shots, what a great shot is. So it's kind of twofold.
Well, I love that. And I mean, making both those connections that you get film and then obviously you're teaching them how to compete. That's it. And beyond that, obviously you're transferring some things to, well, you're seeing if some things have transferred to performance, which is awesome as well. So let's dig deeper if you don't mind, because I love when people talk about competition. And wanting to win is okay. You know, obviously that's your job and it's the process and we can talk about all that, but what are some of the specific things that you do in your drills to emphasize competition? Do you have winners and losers? Do you have consequences? Do you track winners and losers? You know, different things like that. What are some of the specific things that you use to emphasize competition?
Well, we do a variety of things. And one thing, just to kind of put things into context, right now, we only have 5 players that are in summer school. We'll have our entire team here in the next summer session. And when the entire team gets here, I've put one of my assistant coaches and my video guy in charge of creating. We're going to have a 3-on-3 championship that will run throughout the entire second session of our summer school. And so, they haven't unveiled all the details of that to me yet, but that's basically what I said I want to do. Like, we've got to find a unique way to teach competition, but then to also make it fun. There's 100% going to be winners and losers because that's the reality of what we do. As much as we all like to talk about things like process and all that, that's great. And listen, I believe in that stuff wholeheartedly, but the end goal is to win, is to have more points on the board than our opponent. And so, you know, right now, some of the things that we're doing, like I said, we're playing 3-on-3, and then we incorporate maybe some like pickup types of competition. Like, you know, we shoot for the ball. Who's going to get the ball first? We'll shoot for teams. You know, some of those things you did, you know, when you were playing pickup in high school or in college. But one of the other things that's really emerged in our competition, so we play a game of 6-by-1. And again, we don't do it. It's not 30 minutes. We play a game of 6-by-1s and then play a game of 4-by-1. And then we will do a jump ball and at the free throw line. And it's a 1-possession winner. That's how we finish it. And so it starts with a jump ball and whoever scores first wins. The other element of competition in each one of our games, of our 3 different games we play, though, is that, so whoever, let's say in our first game we're playing a 6-by-1s, you score that last basket, well, now you have to step up to the free throw line, and we all get on the free throw line and line up, and you've got to seal the win by hitting a free throw. And if you don't hit a free throw, then the game is still on. We actually had a game the other day where a team came back from like down 6-2 because the other team could not seal the win with a free throw. They kept hitting the winning basket, but they couldn't seal it. So we try to layer our competition so that there's also some of that game-like pressure and some of those things that hopefully we start to become comfortable with, you know, so that when we're in a situation in January where one of my players who now here in May or June has been hitting pressure free throws and the other coach calls a timeout, where, you know, we can say, look, we've been hitting pressure free throws to win games since May. This is no big deal. You know, just make sure that your routine is perfect and you know you're going to nail that shot. You've already been in this situation multiple times. So, you know, we just try to create situations that we're going to be able to apply to game that ultimately will make a moment, a very big moment, feel like something that woman has already experienced.
Wow, that's
hopefully
awesome.
That'll work, Chris. Yeah. Hopefully that'll work.
I don't know. Well, I believe in you, Coach, and I believe in your players. I couldn't agree more with what you're saying. I love how you put that together for your players. I mean, the 1-possession winner thing is something I'll steal for sure. Because, you know, we've done the free throw to end games and to make sure that someone validates a win. But the 1-possession winner thing is great. Actually, shout out to someone on Twitter. I can't remember who posted this, but they posted a unique idea. And I don't know if you've heard of this before or you saw this, but it was basically something like play to 11, threes are worth 3, layups or possessions at the rim. So if you have post players, post-ups at the rim are worth 2. Anything in the mid-range is worth 1, but you have to get right on 11. And if you go over 11, you go back to 5. So as a way to get your players to think the game and to keep score. Because for me, communication is important for all coaches, but communicating the score is something that I find players don't do enough in practice because, again, you have managers that keep the score, you have different players, and this doesn't solve what happened, obviously, with the J.R. Smith situation, but it's just one of those things that it's like I want players to be more aware of time and score. So it's a way to connect kind of knowing the score. Because really, that's half the battle, is just knowing the score. So yeah, I thought no it was doubt. A really thing. And shout out to whoever shared it, because we've tried it last week and it's been great for our guys to enjoy 3-on-3 even a little bit more.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing the things. And Coach, I can't thank you enough for sharing. And we're going to have you on again at some point, maybe after you get past your first season here, and we can talk more about some of these ideas. But I think for anyone that's listening, they learned what I learned when I met you, and that you're an incredible learner. You ask great questions and you're a great listener. And I think that's something that I think coaches can really take away too, is understanding the value of all those things. And you've already had great success as a head coach. I know you're going to have great success at Clemson. And I hope so many coaches now will follow you, become a fan of yours, and like I am and like I become. And we look forward to seeing how your team and you progress through this season. So thanks for coming on.
No, man, it was my privilege, Chris. I enjoy talking to you. I love your questions. Like I said, I'm trying to be the best I can possibly be at asking questions. And you are an expert in that field for sure. And I admire the way you pursue learning. That was, like I said, I got to pursue some really cool conversations. And the fact that we ended up in the same gym in Detroit that one day was a blessing to me. And I've enjoyed to know you. I'm excited about this podcast. I didn't even know this was going on until you emailed me. And so now I have a new podcast to add to my list. I wrote down your Play to 11 game. You know, I wrote down some other things as we were sitting here talking, because you know, you just have great things to share. And I just appreciate you in a format like this, in a platform, making the things that you learn available to other people. And I think if we all did that as coaches, we'll just see the level of our game continue to grow, whether it's men's, women's, college, pro, high school, whatever it may be. So thank you for doing that. Thanks for having me on. And I hope that our paths cross again real soon.
Thank you, Coach. Just let people know quickly where they can follow you on Twitter, social media.
Yeah, I am Coach AB34. So at Coach AB34.
And we'll include that in the show notes as well, as including a link to your bio and everything else for coaches. But yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, that was the whole point of this podcast. And, you know, we're just getting it going. And it's been amazing just to have real basketball conversations with people and, you know, get beyond all the how did you come up in coaching and get right to the details that can help coaches improve themselves. So thanks for sharing.
Great stuff, buddy. Thank you.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.